Grab your beverages and turn up your interweb. Solving the world's problems 12 ounces at a time. It's Dudes and Beer. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 266 of the Dudes and Beer podcast. Now brought to you by PodcastCadet.com. If you're a fan of podcasting like I am, want to start up a podcast for yourself, your business, your friends, your family, church, school. I guess really not so much church or school anymore necessarily, but yeah, even about the COVID. Feel free to stop on by PodcastCadet.com today. Use the code DUDES20 on your way out the door. They can give you all kinds of great packages, one-on-one private consultation with professionals in the podcasting industry, everything from audio engineers to editors, branding coordinators, graphic designers, distribution, monetization, the whole kit and caboodle right there at PodcastCadet.com. Dudes20 is the code that you want to use on the way out the door. While you're online checking that out, please make sure to go on by Black Box TV. There are so many artists and technicians like myself that have been hit and put out of work due to this COVID shutdown, folks. And unfortunately, we are freelance technicians. This is our passion. It's what we do. We are the reason why shows by like South By happen. And when this happened, man, it was tough. So we are producing this show at the HC Universal Network, along with our friends at Good Counsel Services, to help bring in donations to provide grants for artists, technicians, people like myself, people like maybe you or a family member that you may know that needs financial help during these times. We are trying to provide grants for them, so stop on by and donate today. Blackboxlive.tv is that website. Our guest this evening, the amazing niece of D.B. Cooper, Marla Wynn Cooper, will be on. She is the author of D.B.'s Niece, In the Raw, Unedited. We will be talking about, of course, the infamous case of D.B. Cooper and her relationship to him, how she kind of unraveled this thing as time and life went on for her. And really what's come of it since she found things out, because this is all of a recently closed case, folks. So we will be getting into that and so much more with our awesome guest, Marla Wynn Cooper, author of DB's Niece, In the Raw, Unedited. It will be so great to have her back right after this report from John Bowne about possible nuclear tests from China. Let's check it out.
As the world continues to be distracted by the Chinese coronavirus, the Chinese are utilizing order out of chaos to strengthen their global position.
The true cost of this coronavirus, the loss of life and economic devastation, right now is immeasurable. But what can be counted is the money governments around the world have already spent trying to combat it. So far, it adds up to a staggering $6.5 trillion. In a class action launched in the United States, China is now being sued to get the money back. The lawsuit accuses Chinese authorities of negligence, lies, and cover-ups.
Do you think that there should be some consequences if in the end, you know, China was responsible for all of this?
Well, if they were knowingly responsible, certainly. If it was a mistake is a mistake. But if they were knowingly responsible, yeah, then there should be consequences.
Recently, the New York Post reported China is denying U.S. claims that they are testing nuclear weapons outside of international law. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Zhao Lijian said the U.S. neglects all the facts and makes wanton accusations against China. This is irresponsible and ill-intentioned. Zhao went on to call the claim a complete distortion of the facts. But according to an arms control report from the State Department obtained by the Wall Street Journal, the Chinese Communist Party may be conducting tests within the northwest region of the country using low explosive power. The Economic Times reported, indeed, China fired more than 100 ballistic missiles during testing and exercises in 2019, according to sources close to the U.S. military. Such a figure greatly exceeded what the USA and Russia launched, and it illustrates that China is not decelerating in any way its development of missiles for the PLA Rocket Force. China is attempting to overtake France as the third most powerful nuclear power in the world. Add to this China's military buildup in the South China Sea, a crackdown on democracy in Hong Kong.
At least 15 veteran pro-democracy activists were arrested today in this very high-profile roundup, even though Hong Kong is still reeling from the coronavirus pandemic. Hong Kong's Democratic Party founder, 81-year-old Martin Lee, was arrested and driven to the police station as cameras swarmed around him today. Lee was one of many activists who protested against a since-withdrawn extradition bill that would have allowed Hong Kong residents to be sent to mainland China to stand trial. Authorities say the arrests were made on suspicion of organizing and taking part in illegal assemblies last year.
And a global infiltration of the coronavirus response.
French President Emmanuel Macron had a message for U.S. President Donald Trump. France will not block Huawei or target specific companies. That's despite a concerted effort by American officials to persuade its allies to ban the Chinese tech giant from supplying 5G phone network systems.
Recently, China offered to help both France and Canada with donations of masks, but held the installation of Huawei's 5G over Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and French President Macron's heads. The United Kingdom has already signed on to using the Chinese cancerous spy technology, but the UK has recently had second thoughts after China's lack of transparency on the coronavirus came to the fore. The world's reliance on China, cloaked in a one-world policy, has to end before the Chinese century endgame directives infiltrate any further. John Bowne reporting.
John Bowne always laying down some great knowledge. It was really surprising to hear that they were, well, I guess not truly surprising to hear that China was out testing weapons, things like that right now. If you want to hear more from John Bowne, make sure to stop on by Daily News Collective. He is there 24/7 to give you some great content. We love playing his stuff here. Our guest this evening, so excited to have her back on. We had her on about a year ago. Her name is Marla Wing Cooper. She is the author of the book DB's Niece, In the Raw, Unedited. It is available in the Dudes and Beer bookstore. It is also available on Amazon. Make sure to go on by and check that out. Marla, welcome back to the show. How are you this evening?
Thank you, Chris. I'm great. I'm doing really good. Thank you.
Fantastic. I have been, like I said, thoroughly enjoying my digital copy of the book here lately. It was great for us to kind of reconnect, I guess, about a month or so ago. Then things kind of went awry with all of the COVID lockdown, things like that in the world. And episode focuses shifted real quick, as they tend to do whenever the news cycle does. So thank you so much for your patience and for coming on the show,
pleasure.
As always.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
It's not like there's a big demand for my time these days.
I interviewed an author of a monitor engineering book the other day for Talking Sound that came out like a week ago. And that's what he said was like, oh, gee, let me check my, I'm available, man. He was like, typically I'd be on the road and I don't know if I'd have a day to be able to talk with you for an hour, but I got nothing but time.
Exactly.
Oddly enough. If you're a podcast host out there and you aren't getting guests on your show, you're slacking. Cause ain't none of them doing nothing right now. You could get just about anybody.
And yet you're choosing to talk to me.
Because it's such an exciting story. Such an exciting story, Marla. I was chatting with somebody on the road not too long ago about our conversation and about the book. And I was like, you've got to check it out. If you've ever heard the story of D.B. Cooper, if you have ever been interested in this story, this is one of the sides that you really need to hear. It is really – such an interesting facet to what has become literally Americana, American folklore and myth and legend. This is as close to modern myth and legend as you can get, folks. The story of D.B. Cooper and the fact that it is still to this day the only unsolved case of airline piracy ever in FBI records is still phenomenal. Let's kind of start getting into things a little bit. Tell everybody how you remember your uncle. And how you came to realize that your uncle was D.B. Cooper to begin with.
Okay. Well, it's so funny. I wish that we could just snap out of the middle the year and plus months that have gone by since we last spoke.
Because yeah,
that was such a good conversation. We were on the phone for about 3 hours while I recapped every nuance of my memory. And obviously, this is going to be a new audience, a different audience. But so I'll just sort of recap from, you know, my early childhood. I grew up in the Pacific Northwest. I was born in Redmond, Oregon. My family home at that time was Bend. Bend Sisters and Redmond are all in this little tight triangle in the high desert of central Oregon. Mm-hmm. And our family was from the little town of Sisters, Oregon. That's where my parents grew up, went to school, and I was the second of three. And my grandmother's house was in Sisters, Oregon, and that was where we would gather for holidays. My dad was in power line construction, and so we moved with the power line. We moved from place to place. Army brats usually have 2 years in a town. I went to four different first grades. My parents we moved constantly. Mm. And so my childhood was pretty chaotic. And the one grounding force was going to grandma's house. And, you know, we would be there at Thanksgiving and or Christmas. Usually we would take a trip in the summertime. And, you know, she was the constant. And when we would go home to grandma's, I would usually see some of my dad's brothers. One or two would be around. You know, family members were going to be there like Christmas and Thanksgiving. And my dad, he was one of five sons who lived, and he was the second youngest. And the brother who was next older than him was Lynn Doyle Cooper. And LD is actually the guy who was on the plane. But he had an accomplice on the ground who was the next oldest brother, Dewey Clyde Cooper. And so what I remember of the two of them is, you know, just, I mean, my normal memories of childhood were just gathered in my her house was made of like all of the houses in the neighborhood where she lived. It was Brooke Scanlon Camp outside of Sisters, Oregon, which is no longer in existence. But the houses in the camp were made of rail cars. So repurposing rail cars to use them for housing. And that, back in the 40s and 50s, and that's when her house was built. And it wasn't a big house. There were, I think her house, I mentally tried to figure out, was it three or four rail cars that they used for the material? And, you know, but it did have a pretty good size living dining room area. And, you know, we would go home at holiday time, and dad and they were all musicians, except for one brother who didn't play an instrument. But they, you know, there were always guitars played bass. My dad, they had a band when I was growing up. His youngest brother was the drummer. So, you know, the first thing that would happen is all the musical instruments would get set up. And the family, you know, there was just always singing. There was a lot of the Ventures music. They did a lot of country and Western swing dance type stuff. They nice. Did some old ballads, you know, a little bit of rock. It was just a vast mix of music. Conversations were always about, you know, what's the latest songs they're learning, you know, whatever. And they'd, you know, have stories to tell. And I was cousins who would be outside running and playing and climbing trees. And I loved doing all of that, too. But I really was interested in what the adults were talking about. And so I was kind of that fly on the wall. I think that from the time, I think I talk about this in my book, that I was really more interested in, you know, spying on people than engaging with whatever the kids were doing. That wasn't all that interesting. What was going on with the adults was far more interesting to me. And I think that I had a pretty good grasp of things, even though I was really young. I was very intuitive and, you know, sympathetic, empathetic to people's feelings. And, you know, I could tell when people were troubled or they were angry. You know, I was pretty clued in. I think children really are. I think that naturally we're curious and we're intuitive and we're very perceptive. And so what I remember of LD specifically was that of my dad's brothers, besides my dad, he was the kindest. Actually, a very sweet guy. He was funny. He was somewhat, I would say, insecure in some ways, but just he was the one I gravitated to. If LD was around, I was close by. I wanted to be where he was because I was really, for some reason, intrigued by him. And, you know, I've heard these concepts of, which I really agree with this, our future self speaks to us. Mm. You know, they're those friends, like instantly there's a bond. And I think that time is folding up. And I mean, I have friends who have been my friends for 40 and 50 years. And I think, God, you know, the day I met you, I knew we were going to be, it was like this, there was something already so familiar, right? Well, it was sort of that way with LD, I think. I've had so many years to reflect on this that I think as maybe my future self knew that that little girl who was so intrigued by that man, there was something to him that I needed to be, that I needed to understand, that I needed to be focused on. And, you know, I wish I'd had more time with him, but there was a particular Thanksgiving. It was 1971, and at that time, Washington. And we went to Grandma's house for Thanksgiving. We got there a day or two early, and my uncles, LD and Dewey, were there already, and they were planning something. They were outside. They were talking in really hushed tones. They were making innuendos as if they had something up their sleeves, that something was going on. And I kept inquiring. I was really, you know, kind of nagging them because what they were talking about, I wasn't satisfied by the answers I was getting. They kept telling me they were going on a turkey hunt. They were going to go hunt turkeys. And I was really curious about this because it's like, wait a minute, you know, Thanksgiving is tomorrow and you're going turkey hunting. And what if you don't come home with a turkey? You know, and I don't know what day of the week we got there, but I do know that they were so focused on this, and they dragged this duck blind out of my grandmother's shed. I'd never seen it before. And it was something that I guess my dad had built with his brothers when they were younger. And you know, this just looked like a cool fort to me. The thing was kind of held together with those screw eye and hook type of locks. And it just, I thought it was just really neat how they engineered this thing. And I wanted to play in it. And, you know, I think they just had the duck blind up as a ruse. They didn't take the duck blind with them when they left to go on this turkey hunt. It was still in my grandmother's yard when they took off. And, so the next thing I know is, you know, it's Thanksgiving morning and I am up early. I was on the driveway when the two of them came back very, very early in the morning. And I don't recall anybody else being there with me. My sister has implied that she was there, which she might have been, but I don't remember her being there. And my dad's last conversation with me, he seemed to, you know, his belief was that I was the only one who knew what had happened, but it's a moot point, but I'm just trying to describe the scene.
Absolutely.
I was just up in the tree, I think, when they drove up, and I came down and, you know, ran to the car because I wanted to see if they'd caught a turkey. And, you know, if there was actually a turkey that I was going to get to see up close and personal with his feathers on him. And they instead, you know, when I get to the side of the car, Dewey is behind the wheel of the car and LD is in the passenger seat. And I'm running to the window and I said, "Did you get a turkey?" You know, and I looked in the window and I see LD just... He's terribly injured. He's wearing a white t-shirt. And I just remember blood being on the t-shirt and macerated. I mean, he was bloody. He was a bloody mess. That's the only way that I can describe it. And I was distraught at seeing him like this and freaked out, of course. You know, you're seeing your favorite uncle torn up. I mean, something terrible has happened to him.
Yeah.
And I said, and I'm 8 years old when that happened. I was eight. I was in the third grade, and he looked unconscious, like he couldn't really talk. He said, I don't remember him saying much of anything. But my uncle Dewey was yelling at me, "Go get your dad, Marla, go get your dad. You should just shut up and go get your dad." And I was like, "What happened to LD?" And he said, "We got in a wreck." And I'm looking at the car they're driving. And I said, "No, your car is, there's nothing wrong with the car." And he said, "God damn it, Marla, just go get your dad." And I, you know, in such a tone that it actually frightened me. And, you know, it's a highly emotional, intense situation. I ran inside. I'm screaming at my dad, "Daddy, Daddy, you know, LD's hurt." I don't remember what I said, but I yelled at him. And he came out to the driveway and he was really freaked out. He's like, he is screaming at his brother, especially at Dewey. And, you know, in retrospect and after talking to Dewey's stepdaughter about this further, she kind of clarified some things. She said, you know, he'd been, when they came to her house, he was really drunk, Dewey was, which was not unusual, and probably doing drugs of some kind. And I remember my father, when he walked to the side of the car, Dewey's trying to be cool and Dewey's gotten out of the car and he's gone to LD's side, the passenger side by now, and is really worried. I mean, he was terribly upset and Dewey's telling him, "Don, our money problems are over. We're rich. We just have to go back and find the money," you know, and the way he said it, there's just a slight little problem here. You know, he's making a joke, but all I'm hearing is, oh my God, we're rich. You know, because my whole life we'd been terribly poor, and you know, all my parents ever seemed to talk about was their money struggles. At this point, I'm like, well, hey, things must be good. You know?
Yeah, things must be going all right.
Dancing around the yard. I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
Oh no, I said things must be going great if that's what they're saying. The money troubles are over.
Exactly. That's kind of what I thought was, oh wow, you know, something's okay here. And dad is like, I told you, get inside that, get back in the house, you know, don't say another word, whatever. But I'm hiding around the corner at the back door and can hear them talking. And I hear Dewey tell my dad that he said something about hijacking, and you know, off they left. My dad was like, you've got to get him out of here before mom comes back. I think my grandmother and my mother had gone into town and were not home. I believe that they'd gone to the restaurant where my grandmother worked and were baking pies, probably had the turkey, the real turkey, in the oven there. And, you know, grandma had pies that she made for Thanksgiving dinners and stuff. So that was kind of a normal thing that she would have been at the restaurant on Thanksgiving morning. And so then my dad takes me to the another back step off of my grandmother's house. It was actually right off the bedroom where LD lived. And he tells me that what I've just witnessed, I can never tell anybody. He said, you know, Marla, I would never keep a secret from your mother, but this is a matter of life and death. It is that serious. He said, what your uncles have done, that if the police found out, LD would die. They would kill him. It would be a death penalty.
Wow. And
of course, but I understood that if I opened my mouth, my Uncle LD was a dead man. And of course, and he was like never that serious. You know, this was obviously something catastrophic that had happened. And, you know, really one of the few times in my life that anything catastrophic had happened up to that point in all of my big 8 years. But it was incredibly intense, you know?
Yeah.
And so that Thanksgiving I can go back into later, but what I've learned about LD and what I knew then that LD was different from his brothers. The family explained it that he had epilepsy and that he would have these seizures, and that when he was in the Korean War, something had happened to him because he could just lose his mind at the drop of a hat, where before he'd always been a pretty quiet, reserved, I guess, kind of a little bit on the goofy side, maybe, but not like the class clown, more like the guy who followed orders and did what he was told, I guess.
Yeah.
Hard worker. They were all very hard workers. He worked as a lumberjack and growing up. I mean, that was their summer work. They worked out for the Forest Service or for the Brooks Scanlon Forestry Company, harvesting trees. And, you know, so they were all strong, really, really strong men, not big bulky guys, really, by what we think of as strong now. But, you know, they were just very physical, very hardworking guys. Sure. But what I know now, and actually my father had alluded to it when he was alive, is that he was in what we would call special forces. He was in, he did black ops work. Mm-hmm. He was employed by Air America and continued doing that work for some time after the hijacking. But he, at that point, for like 16, 17 years had been, or maybe even longer, actually, I think it was more like 20 years, had been doing black ops work, and that it started in during the Korean, never really stopped. He had a job, you know, he had some kind of a day job that he did, but he, you know, he made his real money doing that. And it was, I had no idea that he had money. I do know that he and Dewey would always come, when they came home, they were driving really nice cars, to, you know, always seemed to have money for going out and partying and playing around, or at least. But he didn't come by it in conventional ways, let's say. But yeah. It was, you know, I truly kept my word when Dad said, you can't talk about this and you just need to forget that it happened. I blocked it out of my mind. And that Thanksgiving, the Macy's parade was not on TV because it was preempted by news of this hijacking that had happened. I mean, it was like 9/11.
Yeah.
You know, there was no TV happening. Every channel was about this hijacking.
Yeah.
And I remember looking at the composite drawings of the hijacker and thinking, you know, it could be anybody, but not making the connection. This was my uncle. They're talking about my uncle. This thing that had just happened on the driveway. I just was, I thought, well, wow, hijackings must be cool.
Well, and you know, it's just the fact of it, an 8-year-old is really more worried about why Snoopy it can go and buy today than what the hijacking is about, you know?
Right.
That's just the mentality of an 8-year-old. And you can't really blame you for that. But going back through your memory banks years later and recovering this and remembering it is really where things start kind of not necessarily unraveling, but coming together for you as a puzzle. And just to give our listeners out there that may not be familiar with the case, I'm going to give them a quick synopsis of that evening. And then we can start going into some of your uncle's black ops works, some of the circumstances that you came to find out from the FBI agents that you have been in touch with over the years, the circumstances of the monies that were given to D.B. Cooper. Things like that. So on November 24th, 1971, a man known only as Dan Cooper purchased a ticket aboard a Northwest Orient Airlines Boeing 727 flight from Portland International Airport to Seattle Tacoma International Airport. The man then proceeded to extort $200,000, the modern value of close to $1.3 million, and made his way to the rear of the aircraft. It was at that point that he opened the aft stairwell and jumped, parachuting his way out. And when he was on the plane, he actively, and this is directly from your book here, he actively said, "Miss, you'd better look at that note. I have a bomb." The note was printed in neat all capital letters with a felt pen. It read approximately, "I have a bomb in my briefcase. I will use it if necessary. I want you to sit next to me. You are being hijacked." And at that point, he dictated his demands for $200,000 in negotiable American currency, 4 parachutes, 2 primary and 2 reserve, and a fuel truck standing by in Seattle to refuel the aircraft upon arrival. Now, the 2 parachutes or 4 parachutes, rather, I think is one of the big things that you really have to consider, folks, because like she said, whenever her uncle came back, he said, all we have to do is go get the money. That's it. And to try and jump out of the back of one of those planes is pretty tough. I mean, 727, it's got a rear aft. An aft staircase that drops down. And oddly enough, your uncle, as you said, was involved in Air America, things like that. These planes were actually retrofitted and used during Air America and other subsequent programs because of their drop capability from the rear.
Yeah, it's interesting. There were so many talking points that you mentioned. One of them being the plane in particular.
Yeah.
And I think having learned what I've learned about that hijacking and remembering the things that were hot news at the time and then learning about why the hijacking happened, what was it part of, who ordered the hijacking, because this wasn't what we're told and the official narrative is it was a lone man who just lost his mind and got on the airplane and decided to hijack it.
Yeah.
And that's not at all what happened. I have come to believe that it, and I'm certain of it, that it was part of a much larger CIA operation that was originally presented to Kennedy. It had gone past the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and it's called Operation Northwoods.
Yep.
And of course, Kennedy shot it down, and Operation Northwoods supposedly never came to be, but it did come to be. It was probably named something else, and we don't know what it was, but the initiatives that were part of that operation happened. If you look at history, what happened during the Cuban Missile Crisis and the Cold War years, Operation Northwoods very much happened. And that hijacking, as well as many other hijackings that were happening at the same time, were all part of the same operation. Well, what's really interesting is there was an amazing book written about propaganda back around the turn of the last century. And the book was written by Sigmund Freud's nephew. And it became the handbook for Hitler's propaganda machine. And we're no different here in the U.S. And when my eyes were opened to what was really happening and why, as many times as I told the story of the hijacking and, brought forward witnesses and evidence and things, none of that breaks the barrier of the official narrative to get to the ears of Americans. And that was especially true during the History Channel documentary that was made and released in 2016. And, yet I would say another propaganda piece. But that was when I really started realizing there was propaganda that was in place to lead into the hijacking, to prepare hijacking and get us prepared mentally. Oh my God, we're not safe to get on an airplane.
Yeah.
We need to make sure that nobody getting on the plane has a bomb. And what one of the big propaganda events that happened just a year before the hijacking was the release of the movie Airport. Mm-hmm. And the movie Airport had an all-star-studded cast. It had the largest marketing budget of any film that had ever been produced. And it was based on a book written by Sir Arthur Haley. And I think that I've got the author right, who worked for British intelligence. And he wrote this book called Airport that is pretty dang close to how the hijacking went down. Mm. This man gets on a plane and he's got a bomb and the airport authorities have no right to search what he's carrying on. Right. Because he didn't have to show ID at that time.
Yeah.
He just walked up to an attendant and said, "My name's Joe Blow. Give me a ticket. I want to fly over here."
Yeah. You just paid somebody cash, got a ticket and walked on a plane.
Yeah, it cost him $20 to get on a plane with supposedly with a bomb. I think he had a fake bomb. It wasn't real. He had like air. He had flares and a battery.
Yeah.
The flight attendant wasn't going to know what a bomb looked like.
Yeah.
But he had something that she could have interpreted for a bomb. But here's the interesting thing. That movie Airport, and I believe this is a key piece of the puzzle. The movie Airport featured a 727 plane that was actually owned by the Flying Tigers. The Flying Tigers were the cargo carriers for the CIA. So the what movies do we have today? Well, maybe they still do, you know, have like a commissary.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
For our propaganda movies. Oh, let's just borrow it from, let's borrow the plane from the CIA to make this film. It was the film itself was a propaganda piece. And, you know, so much of what I think we're still seeing that comes out of Hollywood, it's the same. It's the same. I can hardly sit through a movie because I think, okay, because I, you know, I'm watching these, now I'm really intrigued by so many of the conspiracies that, you know, we're programmed to mock at people who believe in conspiracies and to think they're just crazy. But I mean, you look at what's happening. I mean, what are the odds of this crazy virus? Yeah. You know, here we are living in the history of the world. There's never been anything like this.
Yeah.
Not that it's killed so many people, but that it's so commercialized.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody in the world knows about this virus and how it's, you know, so dangerous, it's deadly, it's going to kill us if we go outside, and we should be really, really afraid. Well, while we're all glued to the TV, you know, or glued to our, in my case, my Twitter account, seeing what people are posting, you know, watching for the next cue drop.
Yeah, yeah.
What's happening? What's happening that we're not paying attention to? And but the plane itself, nobody knew you could skydive out of that plane. That was the only people who knew about that were the CIA officials who ordered those planes to be designed that way. And the guys who flew the plane during the test flights over Laos, because that plane was used during the Vietnam conflict. We weren't supposed to be in Laos and or in Thailand. But I mean, we weren't supposed to be in Thailand. We weren't supposed to be in Turkey. We were in all these other places besides Vietnam. And it's like everybody's glued to what's happening in Vietnam. But there were a lot of other things happening at the same time. And those planes, there were only a handful of men in the military who had jumped out of that plane. And so that the hijacker even knew you could skydive out of it is incredibly significant.
Yeah.
Because it was just such a small, you know, and that's how secrets get kept. Everybody knows what they know on a need to know basis.
And especially whenever you're talking about the year in which this happened, you know, when you're talking 1971, there was not like necessarily an extreme sports community. There were not a whole lot of people out like skydiving, you know, that kind of stuff. So those communities were just starting to get going shortly after that. So how would you have the knowledge to know that you needed a parachute and a reserve chute? You know?
Yeah. And the suit that he actually skydived with, I think it was called a Navy Back 6 NB6. That's the one. That was really the only suit he wanted, because that was the exact suit that had been that he had worn when he was jumping out of planes in Korea and in Vietnam. I mean, that was the backpack he was familiar with.
Yeah.
And so the naysayers, the critics, the D.B. Cooper sleuths, whoever, they say, well, if he'd known what he was doing, he would have never picked that particular parasite, because it was unmaneuverable. You know, he would have picked this slick sport parachute that was given to him, yeah, because there were four parachutes, and he asked for four. And I agree with this belief that he wanted the authorities to believe that he was going to take a hostage with him, you know, so that they would comply, or at least that's how he was. I think that that makes sense. But the thing is, the money was already, well, anyway, I'm kind of jumping ahead here.
That's all right.
But to me, it was really obvious that, you know, knowing what I know now, he had been either programmed for this, prepared for it. He was clearly handled during this. I mean, as an operative, you have handlers who make sure that you're doing what you're supposed to be doing. There's somebody watching you. You don't just have an assignment and you're entrusted to you know, fulfill your obligation to do what you're supposed to do. There are handlers nearby watching you, and that was definitely the case with the hijacking. But just the specifics of the plane ride too. Okay, it's the day before Thanksgiving. It's busy. The airport is busy by all accounts. It was bustling, just like today. Air travel was very common. It was incredibly commercialized. You know, one of the greatest advertising phenomena in history was what happened to airline travel during from the early 60s into, you know, the late into the 70s. It was a phenomenon, because up until, you know, in the 50s, people would travel and stuff, but they were like old, ugly, we used in
dual
the
prop planes.
It wasn't a pleasant experience. Yeah. These were gray, military, ugly planes. And now airline travel became convenient and inexpensive and glamorous. And I mean, people would get dressed up to get on a plane.
Yeah.
And it was really it was like going out to eat dinner in a great restaurant, but everybody, you know, most people could afford to do it. And so here it is, it's the day before Thanksgiving. He's on the tail end of, you know, this particular flight was part of what's called a milk route. The plane had begun somewhere on the East Coast, and it just made stops, you know, kind of hopped along the U.S. And the last flight of the day was going from Portland to Seattle, Tacoma. And he gets on that plane. And there are only 36 passengers on board. That plane seated 110 passengers, and it's only $20 to fly from Portland to Seattle the day before Thanksgiving, when college kids are, you know, trying to get home. And that was the thing that was told in one of the books about the hijacking, was the airport was bustling with activities as businessmen were trying to get home, college students are trying to get home, and air travel's traveling smoothly. Why were there only 35 people on that plane? It doesn't make any sense. It's 2 o'clock in the afternoon. You go to any airport on the day before Thanksgiving in the U.S. with a popular commuter route like that.
Yeah.
That plane's going to be packed. There are going to be people waiting. And this was true in the early 70s as well. So the fact that there were only a select few people on that plane is really interesting. You know, you can read about the statistics of the hijacking, and that's sort of a, you know, there were only this many people on board. Well, we don't really think about that, because it's really common that I would go get on a smaller jet to take a small flight. No, this was a big ass plane.
Yeah, and it was definitely a large plane
when he got on it, because that was the particular plane that he knew he could skydive out of. He asked the airline attendant, "Is this a 727?"
Yeah,
and was told yes, because he would have waited for another flight.
Yeah.
And if it hadn't been the 727.
You know, you were speaking a minute ago about handlers, things like that. One of the very interesting things that we discussed in the last episode was exactly how the money came about getting to DB on the plane, because he of course stopped, you know, they stopped at an airport. That's where they met them. They gave him the money. They gave him the parachutes, and then the plane left again, and it was supposed to be met on the ground in order to be refueled.
Right.
And go on with his demands at that point.
Right.
But the bank that the money came from, especially given your uncle's history, his past, his work in black ops, things like that, it was very interesting to find out some of the history behind the bank itself that the money came from. Let's get into that for a moment.
Well, let's go back just a second.
Sure.
Because I want to talk about how the flight itself is like, I don't remember how long it takes. It's like an hour flight.
Yeah, it's a puddle jump.
That's how long the flight should have taken. And as soon as the plane took off, that's when he gave the flight attendant the note. That's when there was communication between the Portland tower and SeaTac that the plane's being hijacked.
Yeah.
Here are the demands. When he lands, you've got to have all this stuff. You know, they've got an hour to get everything there, right?
Yep.
And again, it's a table for Thanksgiving, so there's a lot of, I'm sure there's traffic and all this stuff, right? But yet they've got to come up with $200,000 in $20 bills that are randomly ordered, right? So the story is that the bank already had that money, that this particular bank, I guess, is the go-to bank. If there's a kidnapping or whatever, you know, this money's already there and bundled. And so we're told, and this may or may not be true, that every one of those bills was photographed. But I think every one of those bills was photographed long before the hijacking happened.
Yeah, there's no way you're going to be able to count $200,000, and photograph every single bill. There's just no way. Not even in an hour. I'm sorry. Not in 1972. There was barely even Polaroid at that point, man.
Right. So we know but Ralph Himmelsbach, who was the lead investigator out of Portland, out of the Portland Bureau of the FBI, his book called Norjack, you know, he gives this history, and he did not write that book, I'm sure of it. I mean, he probably consulted on it, but he had a ghost writer. But there's a lot of stuff that was in his book that I'm going, I can't believe anybody reading this book couldn't put together what was really going on. Because really his book was a lot of what opened my eyes, you know, that while the plane is in flight, there's a communication. So the plane, it would be Delta Airlines now, but then it was Northwest Orient, and it was headquartered out of Minneapolis, Minnesota, which, by the way, is where the movie Airport was made. It was featured the same exact airport, which is interesting to me. But Northwest Orient communicated to Seattle. Somebody in the Northwest Orient headquarters communicated to Seattle while the plane was in flight. Be sure that the courier, when they bring the money to the plane, is not wearing his uniform, because our friend, meaning the hijacker, has a previous arrest record for drunkenness, and we don't want him to think this guy's a cop. And so that's when I knew, when I read that, and this is in the transcripts of the flight. I've actually looked at the flight transcripts, which they've been spliced, but you can look at them on the FBI website. There is, right after that remark is made, there's like 7 minutes of the transcript that has obviously been cut.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's very obviously cut. And if I think I actually have pictures of that in the book where it's cut, and you can see it's cut. I mean, the type is all it's going one direction, and I mean, it's a bad cut and paste job. And but it was while the plane was in flight that Northwest Orient made that remark, so they had to have known the identity of the hijacker to have said that. That he had a previous arrest record for drunkenness. And at this stage of the game, they don't know who's hijacking. They don't know the name of the person hijacking the plane. Because when that guy got on the plane, it's not like, I mean, he shows the ticket to the flight attendant, but until the passengers disboarded and they compared the passengers who got off to the flight manifesto, they did not know that the hijacker was this Dan Cooper character. Huh. And so that Northwest Orient knew of his previous arrest record told me they knew who the hijacker was. If somebody, that's when I went, he was assigned to do this. You know, he was, when I saw that, I was actually in Portland, I believe, at the time. Yes, I was in Portland, and I had gone to Powell's bookstore to buy Ralph Himmelsbach's book, and they had one copy of it in this vast, amazing bookstore in downtown Portland, and I've sat in my hotel room reading this, and I mean, I could have fainted when I saw that. And yeah. I called my mother, who was still alive at the time. And I was like, oh my God, you're not going to believe. And, you know, I told her this, and she's like, Marla, you're going to get yourself shot.
Well, you know, let's leave that right there. We actually have to say goodbye to our WMLD audience. Thank you guys so much for tuning in. If you want to hear the rest of this interview and what happens when mother says, you need to shut up or you're going to get shot, make sure to stop on by the Dudes and Beer website. Dudesandbeer.com is where you can find all the episodes. That is where you can find the continuance of this episode. Now, Marla, once you get that warning from your mom, where do you start going with things? Because, you know, like we said, there's a lot of connection here with Black Ops, with CIA, not only your uncle's previous military history and training, and not only the connection with the airplane and the model being used by Air America, things like that in Laos. But starting, like we said, going into the bank itself and how this money was attained, like you said, like to get $200,000 together within an hour with all that logistics, who the heck has $200,000 just sitting somewhere waiting to go?
Right.
So let's start exploring that a little bit.
Sure. Well, the plane was actually, they just continued orbiting, circling the airport for, I believe, over 2 hours. You know, it's been a long time since I was heavily in the research, but it was a really long time. I think altogether they were in the air something like 3.5 hours. It should have been a single should have been just an hour, but they kept telling the passengers, you know, oh, the airport's too busy, we can't land, or we're having, you know, some kind of little issue or whatever. And yet these passengers on board were like, oh, you know, they didn't even realize, supposedly, nobody even realized they were being hijacked because, you know, but they did think it was really odd that they hadn't landed yet, you know?
Yeah. It's just bizarre. Yeah, that when you're on a puddle jump of a 45-minute flight.
Right. So when I went through the transcripts and I'm reading and doing an analysis of the things that he said, you know, like he made a remark. It's so bizarre to me. The people who write this, you know, the narrative is he was obviously familiar with the landscape. He must have been from around there because he knew it was only 20 minutes to – he recognized McCord Air Force Base.
Okay.
When they flew over, right? But what had actually happened was – he was complaining, why is this taking so long? You were supposed to have everything there when we landed. You know, he knew they were plotting something. They were going to take him out. You know, they were going to kill him. They were trying to figure out how they were going to kill him when he landed. And he was demanding, I mean, because he knew that these parachutes were going to come from McCord Air Force Base. And he's like, McCord is only 20 minutes, but the narrative is, oh, he recognized McCord Air Force Base when we flew over. But he was pissed because it should have only taken, you know, at the most 20, you know, we're being hijacked and we need these four parachutes. And you know, the story is, oh, well, McCord didn't have any parachutes to spare. Bullshit.
Yeah.
It's comical, really, when you think about it, what we're told about this hijacking and what had to have happened, right? But the bank itself, and you probably, since you're reading, I know you've been reading the book, and it's been so long since I wrote the book. I don't remember, but it seems like it was a there's something about the bank that particularly was unusual. It wasn't just your run-of-the-mill, you know, bank. It was specifically like probably a money laundering bank.
Yes. Yeah, it was straight up connected to the CIA and used for situations of negotiation.
Yes.
Where they had money just sitting ready to use for negotiation of spies, things like that, ransoms, right, and the like.
Okay. And now that's coming back, and I'm sorry.
That's okay. That's okay. Cause that was one of the things that was, like you said before the show, I had a lot of notes, and that was one of the things that specifically stuck in my mind, was like, wow, the history of this
bank,
the history of this bank to begin with.
Yeah.
And, you know, and a lot of that, you know, it was really interesting to find out that you spent a lot of time with the FBI investigators, with the FBI, things like that. And
yeah, I went through an FBI investigation. So what triggered that happening was, we fast forward from the hijacking to 1995, and it's Christmas time. And my father, I've gone home to visit my dad, and we live in about a year and a half after the hijack, and we moved to the desert of New Mexico. It was like, okay, things are too heated here. So we vanished. The Pacific Northwest had been our home, and now we lived in the desert of New Mexico. And my dad still lived there when, you know, I was going through a divorce. And I went home to see him, sort of a last minute trip, and we were sitting at his countertop reminiscing that the spring before that, you know, my brother, my sister, and all of the kids, and we'd all gathered for this big, you know, we were all home at the same time. And we were talking about how nice that was, that the whole family was together. Mm. And I said, you know, it really kind of felt like those holidays at grandma's house from, you know, it was just so nice to have the whole family together. This is what holidays are supposed to be like. And we'd had no holidays like that since I was 8 years old. And I mean, after the hijacking, it's like whatever holidays we celebrated together, you know, there was the last 1 year after the hijacking was the last time I saw LD, and that was at Christmas time, and he had vanished for good. I never saw him again. And so I asked my dad, you know, we're sitting at his counter now, I'm however old I was, 95, I was 32. And I said, Dad, what do you think? Have you heard from Uncle LD? you know, what do you think happened to him? He's like, no, I haven't heard from him. And I said, that's just so him since I was 9 years old.
Yeah.
A year after the hijacking. And he said, he goes, well, I think he's still hiding. And I was like, well, what do you mean he's hiding?
Hiding from what?
And he said, yeah, I just totally had, you know, I literally had forgotten all of this. And he said, Marla, don't you remember? He's hiding from the CIA. He's hiding from the FBI. And I said, and I was laughing. So I was like, oh, Dad, you're such a crazy conspiracy theorist. What are you talking about? He's hiding from the FBI and the CIA. And he says, don't you remember? He hijacked that airplane and Dewey helped him. And I was like, I went, wait a minute. It's like a switch clicked on. He said, when he said that, I went, I remember knowing that my uncle is a hijacker, but that's really all I remember. And, you know, and then it's like these pictures are flashing through my mind of us sitting on the back step. And, you know, it's like I saw little glimpses of it at that time. And he said, yeah, he goes, my God, I can't believe you don't remember this. Marla, you were there. You know, we talked about it. I was really just kind of stunned by what he was saying. And he goes, you've got to go to the library. You need to look up books about D.B. Cooper. And I go, what do you mean D.B. Cooper? What are you talking about?
Yeah.
His name was L.D. He goes, I know, but that's, you know, he was trying to explain to me what that meant, why it was DB, why it wasn't LD. And I was just thinking, by the minute, my dad's lost his mind. You know, I really wasn't connecting. And he just stopped, you know, just like when you know about the conspiracy, but nobody believes you, and they're just totally clueless, and you're just exasperated.
Yeah,
that's where dad was at that. He said, because, you know, we gave him shit my whole life. Dad, you're such a crazy conspiracy theorist. We wouldn't let him tell us stuff, even if he'd wanted to. And he goes, Marla, you know what happened. You need to write a book about this. And he's like, if you just read what happened, you'll remember. I know you'll remember. You really need to write a book about this. I mean, and he just wouldn't let it go. And I was like, yeah, okay. Well, I got to go to bed, you know, because it was in the middle of the night. And by now I'm tired. And he continued with this for the next month. I went back to Tulsa. He's still in New Mexico. And he keeps calling me. Marla, have you gone to the library yet? Have you looked this up? And I'm like, Dad, no, you know, I'll get to it later. I'm busy. I'm working. I'm going through a divorce and yada, yada, yada. It was like, I really didn't take it all that seriously. And he's telling me that it's a famous story, but I'm like, just not feeling the urgency, you know?
Yeah.
And it was actually 1 month later, my dad died. My dad died on January the 30th of 1976, or 1996 was when my dad died. So there was only 1 month of him saying this, and it was like, and the shock of him dying was, he was only 59 years old.
Oh, wow.
He's 3 years older than I am right now. And yet, it was a shock, but it wasn't a shock. Everybody in his family died young. His dad was only in his, like, 61 when she died. He'd already lost a couple of brothers in their 50s, 60s. You know, it was sort of like the Cooper thing. They all die young. But, you know, the next thing I know, 20, how many years have passed? That was 2009 before the subject comes up again. At my mother's 66th birthday party. And my parents had divorced when I was in high school, but it was my mother's. Now we're at my mother's birthday party, and her siblings are there, and my siblings are there, and all the grandkids are there. And I'm kind of having a deja vu. I'm like, this is only the second time since I was a little kid that we've had our relatives all together in a house.
Yeah,
they
yeah.
have this many of us together again. And I'm kind of repeating that mental cycle of how, you know, what was it like? You know, do you guys remember grandma's house? Wasn't it great? You know, wow, what do you think happened to Uncle LD? And that's when my mother said, oh, I'm crazy. And I was like, what are you talking about? He was crazy. He had epilepsy. He wasn't crazy. And my mother, it was like, well, I always knew he was D.B. Cooper. And I'm like, who's D.B. Cooper? What do you mean? What are you talking about? And this is when my sister comes out of her kitchen and is like, do you think Uncle L.D. was D.B. Cooper? And I went, please, what are you talking about? And Maureen goes, you know, the hijacker. And then it was like, I got caught in this vortex. I'm still at Dad's kitchen table. You know, I'm still there at his counter, and we're having that same conversation. Maureen's saying he hijacked the airplane, and Dad's saying it at the same time. And I'm going, oh shit, I'm supposed to be writing a book about this.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's when I went to the FBI, you know, over the next few, I mean, this sort of haunted me. I kept trying to get my mother to talk. She wouldn't. She completely clammed up.
This is one of the things that I find most interesting out of everything involving this and your involvement with it later in life is the camaraderie and really community that you found amongst the FBI investigators. And
yeah.
the relationships that you built with them, the things that you helped them investigate, find out, the rabbit holes that you helped them go down.
Well, what's interesting is I've always felt like the FBI agents were great. You know, at first they didn't want to talk to this crazy woman. You know, everybody thought they were D.B. Cooper's relative,
sure.
Right? And they completely dismissed me. Well, it turned out a client of mine who had been an undercover police officer in the city of El Reno, I guess. So he was out in the western Oklahoma. He's from Weatherford, Oklahoma. This man named Arden Dorney, who I met, and he was talking about having reconnected with his sister after not seeing her for 26 years, and they had just seen each other at a funeral. And I said, you know, and I'd been trying to get the FBI to, and they just ignored me. And I didn't hound them. I wasn't beating their door down. I thought,
yeah,
you know, if I'm supposed to remember this, and I just believe in providence. I believe that we have a destiny. You know, if God wanted me to do this, he'd open the doors and he'd make things happen. And boy, did he.
Yeah.
And one of them was in the form of Arden Dorney, he was 75, 76 years old at that time. And when he's telling me about his sister, I said, boy, I know what it's like to be estranged from a family member. And I was thinking about how, you know, my sister and I hadn't spoken in a few years, but what came out of my mouth was my uncle and, you know, how he had vanished when I was 9 years old and,
yeah.
You know, blah, blah, blah. And he was this hijacker. And Arden had just seen some History Channel something or he'd seen some, you know, it's always been, it never really went away. It's been this mysterious thing
some
forever.
Some Unsolved Mysteries episode or the like.
Right. Yeah, actually, I think that was what he watched. Was Unsolved Mysteries.
I mean, I have grown up with this story. This is one of the, what's hilarious, my son is almost three and watches this show called We Bare Bears. And literally in this cartoon, there is it's literally about three bears, Marla. There's an episode where they find a suitcase as children. And on the suitcase, it says property of D.B. Cooper.
Wow.
Like, that's how far, like I said, this is straight up modern mythos. Like, this, yeah. This is along the lines of Robin Hood, Billy the Kid. You know, like, right. This is the guy that went out, held somebody up for $200,000, jumped out of a plane, and got away with it.
Right.
You know, like, this is literally the stuff that movies are made out of. And yeah. There's not a movie.
Not very good movies.
No.
So far. They're not very good movies.
A few takes.
That are made about it, because they're just... Usually there's some bubblegum kind of a whatever. But in his case, to me, this would be a great movie. And I kept threatening to, I have an agent, you know, and I was going to do, and I'm like, you know what? My life has settled down. I'm happy. I wasn't treated nicely by the press.
No.
You know, I wasn't treated nicely by the media. No. I wasn't treated nicely by D.B. Cooper sleuth. And it's like, It's a lot to me that I know what happened. I wrote the story for other people to know. You know, I probably could improve on it now because I've learned more, you know, since then. But it's like, do I want to continue immersing myself in that, or do I just want to live my happy life?
And here's where, at least where I come down on it as an outsider, someone who, like I said, has followed this case and news about it since I was smooth in my 20s, and I am in my 40s, mid-40s now, Marla. You know, it's hard to associate yourself with such things because, the gavel comes down hard from a lot of media. For me, what it comes down to is the investigators. And most of the investigators, at the least, gave you credence.
I would say the media, the journalists writing the story often, you know, like the story developers, especially that was true with the History Channel. Mm. They truly were intrigued, you know, and then the producers, people, the crew, people, you know, interviewing me, and these interviews would be hours. And the crew, everybody would just be enthralled, listening, hanging on the edge of their seats. And then what gets released is just this bullshit. And there might be some soundbite.
It's chopped forever and always.
Thing. And it's like, they're not in control. Those people, those honest to goodness, hardworking, you know, crew members and journalists, they're not evil, but it's the... what happens in editing.
Absolutely.
Is it sticking with a narrative, and that's a controlled narrative, and who is controlling the narrative?
And, you know, quite honestly, Marla, I have been asked, I belong to so many podcast groups, podcast like advice groups and things, and me and a few other podcasters I know, old school folks, from the broadcast world, that kind of stuff, just kind of laugh whenever we see like the, I spent 5 hours editing my episode. And it's like, why didn't you just do your episode right? You know, like I don't edit because of the content I have and the conversations I have, I am loath to edit somebody's words. I don't ever want to edit somebody's message or snip something out. I was so happy that the couple of words that you dropped a little while ago were after broadcast so that I did not have to do that. Because I hate it. I hate it. And I hated it whenever I was on broadcast where it was like, I have no choice but as a producer right now to chop this out. You know?
Yeah.
And it, because, like at that point, you can, the editor has so much power. So much power to be able to change things, move things, use something that had a different inflection.
Much of a choice when it comes to this story.
Not really.
Or other stories, you know, like 9/11. I mean, there's so much, or the assassination of Kennedy.
Sure.
And how Martin Luther King was killed. You know, there's a narrative. And that's the official narrative. And if you're, you know, if you don't stick with that narrative, then you're just a conspiracy theorist. And we know where that term came from. But in the case of my story, it's like God intervened for me to get to the FBI. Mm. And that was through Arden Dorney and somebody he knew who had been one of the lead investigators in the Murrah bombing, which the anniversary of that was just last Sunday.
Yeah, it was
which
just
was
2 days
also the
ago.
Anniversary of Waco, yep. Which is also the same date that we had. What was it? There was something that happened in Dallas that, simultaneously to this shooting, this mass shooting, 17 yeah. people killed in Nova Scotia. Those were happening at the same time. I mean, it's mm-hmm. what's the deal with the 19th of April?
Yeah. Yeah. No, that I was actively, whenever I was contacting you, I was also trying to contact Cody Snodgrass, and I have not been able to get in touch with him, nor is my contact for him. For a little while, and he is actively the man who came on this show and has written a book in the light talking about how he was approached by the CIA to blow up the Murrah building.
Oh, I think I've heard him in.
Oh, my Lord. You want to talk about a story?
Yeah. Right. And he was offered like $1 million.
Yeah.
You know what? When I heard him talking, he sounds just like Bob Rackstraw to me.
Yeah.
Which, you know, Bob Rackstraw yeah. died last July.
Yeah. I was going to say it was about 6 months after we spoke because I went and started following him. And just so you know, folks, like your host does his background work. He does his backstories. I am always willing to give anybody the platform for discussion because that is what this show is about, Marla. Is open discussion about fringe topics. That's the only way we grow as humanity. But when it comes to somebody like Marla, when it comes to somebody like who approached me the other day and was like, I'm an expert in conspiracy theory. And, you know, I want to come on and talk about the real source of the coronavirus. It's like, okay, well, whatever I'm doing today is now set aside. because it's time for a deep dive now. I got a deep dive into this, and it was quite literally the History Channel documentary that I contacted you from.
Wow.
And
which was
because
such a big nothing.
It was. It was. And I remember whenever I talked to you the first time, Marla, I was like, what, why did these yeah. people not talk about any of this?
Right.
Why did they not get into any of this? And it's not for a lack of you telling them, I'm sure.
No. Oh, no. There were months of story development. And and there was a 45-minute interview they conducted with.
Sure.
Well, and here's what actually happened.
Go ahead.
So I get contacted by the FBI. Curtis Ng out of the Seattle Bureau of the FBI said, there's this company making we're actually assisting the History Channel, I think was how he worded it. They're doing a documentary about D.B. Cooper and we're cooperating. They've tried to reach you and they said you hung up on them and I don't blame you, but if they call back, you know, you might want to talk to them. And I was like, they didn't call me. I would have answered, you know, I didn't get a phone call, but there's more than one Marla Cooper and somebody was pretty lame at doing their research, I guess. And so so Curtis puts me in touch with Ayn Dietrich at the Seattle Bureau of the FBI. And she's like their, I would say the marketing person, but that's not right. I don't remember what her exact title is. She does media relations, whatever. And
POI.
She says, oh, yeah, here's the number.
Or PIO, PIO, public information officer.
Yes. So so then there's like months of talking to this story developer because, you know, they're writing this thing. And
oh,
then,
yeah, no, like their whole episode has an arc. There's a complete ebb and flow to the way that the story's told and everything else.
Right.
And during this third quarter is where we're going to include you because we're going to branch off on the possibilities of what D.B. Cooper may have been.
Oh, no, they don't tell you that.
Oh, no, absolutely not. I'm just telling you the background producer's room.
You're there to just tell your story,
yeah.
Share everything, give them pictures, yep. Let them talk to them about other people who were involved. You know, we went over the Dan Cooper comic book connection, which is, you know, a really fascinating part of that story. And I had been privileged to hear Carol Abrick-Zinkskas, who did a lot of research on the Dan Cooper comics, which is how he came up with this name.
Yeah.
And also how the hijacking occurred was really outlined in this comic book, and, you know, where he sat, what he wore, what he said, even though those comic books were actually written in French. There were so many specific things in the comic books that were carried out in the hijacking. And my uncle had those comic books thumbtacked to the wall of his bedroom at my grandmother's house. And I specifically remembered them because of being locked in that room with my cousins when, you know, adults are out here having conversation and playing music. You kids go play in the bedroom, you know, and it's a tiny little house. There weren't a lot of places to go. And we'd end up in Uncle LD's bedroom and just sitting on his bed and jumping on the bed and wrestling and fighting and whatever. And here are these comic books. It's like there were no toys in this house. The comic book was the only those comic books were the only kid friendly materials in the whole house. You know, we were tree climbers. We had to be inside. We were bored. And so, you know, I remember trying to read these comic books as a kid, and they were written in French, but, you know, it was like this, what, they're one letter off from being my dad's name, Don Cooper. So I was all intrigued by that, but I'm digressing, but all of this went into those, you know, so much information, a 45-minute conversation with a retired general who knew my uncle, who told me he ran a supply operation for Air America during the Cold War years. He knew more about my uncle by far than I did. And all of that was handed to the History Channel story developers on a silver platter. And I got pretty chummy with her because, you know, my story's pretty fascinating.
It is.
And she tells me, oh, you know, we're talking to other people, you know, and there's this one guy, Tom Colbert, who's just convinced that, you know, his guy, Bob Rackstraw, is the hijacker. No, I don't know if she told me. No, she did. She told me his name at that time. And then, you know, I, through a strange series of events, while the History Channel documentary is developing, an old friend of my sister's reaches out to me, and he does films. He did the Sarah Palin story, and he's a producer, and he's really like the money that he partnered with Steve Bannon of Breitbart News.
Oh, and, of course.
Yeah, and I can't remember the other partner's name, Alan Nevins, who's more like an agent. And so my sister's friend, Glenn, was like, oh my God, Marla, I need these guys on board. We need to do something with this story of yours, and yada, yada, yada. He puts me in touch with Steve Bannon. I have this conversation with Steve Bannon about, you know, what I know of the hijacking, how there were these CIA spooks on the plane. Three of the passengers that I know of were CIA spooks. And there were probably more than that. You know, you just look at what people did for their day jobs out of those 35 other passengers. And they're all, you know, most of them were government employees. There were like five women and the rest were men. I mean, the mix it was really odd who was on the plane. But I was told by the daughter of one of those CIA spooks, you know, my dad was also in Memphis when Martin Luther King Jr. was killed, and he was in Dallas when JFK was shot, and he was in LA when Bobby Kennedy was assassinated, and now he's on the plane with DB Cooper, and she's like, I know my dad had something to do with this hijacking. You know, she was afraid that, I mean, she was terrified. She'd lived her life terrified. She died of heart failure a few years ago.
Wow.
But I mean, there were so many pieces of the story that are not told. you know, here, once you talk to Karen Truitt, her dad was on the plane. Wouldn't you like to talk to her? No.
Yeah.
Nobody's interested in knowing the truth. Well, but the story,
hey, man, I'm interested.
Had a good story going. But she, what'd you say?
I'm interested. Bring her on.
I know. Right. I know. She's dead. That's the thing. Everybody's died now. I mean, Bob Rastro's dead. You know, Karen's dead.
What's interesting, and we talked about this during your last episode, Marla, the D.B. Cooper case has been open longer than any FBI case. Like, we're getting ready to have Ram Dennison, the guy who made Money Machine about the Mandalay Bay massacre in Las Vegas. That investigation was closed within a year. That is the largest mass shooting in American history, way beyond $1.3 million or $200,000 in 1972. Okay.
Right.
But yet still this case, and I really think it was just a point of pride on behalf of the FBI to be like, we're not going to let this case go unsolved.
Well, I think there's more to it than that. I think that he had Ralph Himmelsbach's help in going under the wire. Bob Rackstraw told me, and I don't know if I knew this when you and I last spoke.
No, you had just gotten in touch with him. Y'all had just gotten close.
Well, we'd been talking. When I talked to you last year, we had been talking he and I first started talking just a few months after the History Channel aired.
Okay.
You know, so I we'd had several conversations, but I actually went to visit him in February of 2019. So this was after you and I
remember you were saying in the last episode you were getting ready to go talk with him.
Right. Well, one of the things that instigated that trip, that face-to-face trip, was I told Bob, I said, I think I've pieced something together here. And it's the only thing that makes sense. I said, I think that Ralph Himmelsbach must have been one of my uncle's handlers, because I knew Ralph had been the handler for another crazy, crazy black ops guy who lives out in the woods, and he's been looking for the body of D.B. Cooper forever. And Ralph Himmelsbach was his non-commissioned officer in charge on his black ops crap that he did. And so I know this was something that Ralph Himmelsbach did. And the fact that Ralph completely lied to the media in, you know, what his character, what he was like, you know, what witnesses had to say, everything that, you know, you go back and you look at the history of how the story was reported, and the newspapers had to do retractions because the flight attendant went, what do you mean? He wasn't rude. He didn't cuss. He wasn't, and that's not the kind of person he was at all. And I kind of figured out, well, if my son was on the run and I didn't want people to know who he was, I would describe exactly the opposite personality type, what he was like. And that's exactly what Ralph did.
Even the name D.B. Cooper in and of itself was a slip.
Yes.
That happened amongst the initial reports that were going out. And whenever it happened, the FBI was like, let's keep it there. Let's keep D.B. as the name to get rid of any looky-loos or copycats, things like that.
Well, and they say that the name was, you know, immediately stuck in the public collective, that it was misspoken. And there is like a clip of, I think, Walter Cronkite misspeaking and calling him D.B. Cooper instead of Dan Cooper. And then it's like it was just sort of catchy or whatever. But how interesting that he was known as L.D., you know, and then it's D.B. And that's why I was like, and of course I got dogged for that.
It's hard not to go into hypothesis. It's hard not to rabbit hole on things like that, especially whenever you've got the history with the case that you have and that exists, Marla. Because trying to put this together since you've found out has really become an all-consuming effort for you.
Well, I think it was. I don't think it is so much anymore.
Sure.
It's more that by understanding this story, I recognized a pattern, and that keeps my eyes open to what's going on now. You know.
Yeah.
That there were, it's common that an asset would wear out his usefulness. And that was the case with my uncle. You know, he'd aged out of the career, I would say.
Yeah.
And, you know, the other hijackers were all killed. You know, the others who were probably part of that same Operation Northwoods series of hijackings, yeah. They were all killed. Yeah. If they, you know, like in the case of what's his name, McCoy, mm-hmm. He died having escaped from prison, and yeah. You know, yada yada yada. But it's like they want to shut them up, and I think in the case of LD, you know, the Manchurian candidate situation may come into play, where they're brainwiped. They're these controlled assets. They don't really know what they're doing. They don't really remember what they're doing. But yeah. Or in the case of Lee Harvey Oswald, you know, I'm just a patsy.
Well,
you know? and my uncle ended up not being a patsy. He didn't get killed. You know, and that's why the Mandalay Bay thing hit the press so fast. Is here, let's solve this mystery. Oh, he's dead.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Oh, by the way, the guy's dead, so he can't talk. Well, Uncle LD wasn't dead, so he went into hiding. But the woman he married worked for the FBI. So did her mother in Reno, where all the evidence was gathered from the plane. So he was able to go start a new life. You know, and I don't know how that happened. I do know that there were guys in black suits who came and dragged Dewey from my grandmother's house sometime before she died and scared the crap out of him. And he fled to Canada for some time with his girlfriend and their kids. And, you know, he went into hiding. And that was when we left Sisters and moved to another town. And then a year later moved to New Mexico. So, you know, we were all in our state of hiding, but you were talking about the FBI, me being close with the FBI. I think I was probably treated differently than some witnesses. I mean, part of their, you know, if you want to interrogate somebody, you get them to trust you, right? So these guys are friendly. They're nice. They're nice guys, frankly. And you know, really straight arrows, I would say. Mm. And in the case of how my story got to them, it was initially, you know, the Murrow bombing guy. And I don't even know his name. I think his first name is Scott, but I never met him. I wasn't supposed to know his name. And, you know, I would be putting him at risk if I knew who he was, I'm sure, for other reasons. But he built a case file, and Arden was the go-between. And he took that case file to the Seattle Bureau of the FBI. The Seattle Bureau reached out to the field office in Stillwater, Oklahoma, which is where I was living. And a field agent there is who initially contacted me and interviewed me. And I think right before you and I spoke the last time, that particular field officer from Stillwater had reached out to me. He had retired and was going through very, very difficult situation personally and reached out to me of all people. So it tells you, I think I may impact, you know, and we had a really good friendship, and that I think a lot of his being able to resolve what was going on with him had to do with the healing that had happened in my life as a result of all of this D.B. Cooper stuff, you know, that I went inward. I went deep, deep inward and did a lot of deep healing, realizing, you know, how these secrets and keeping stuff hidden inside of us, the cells of our body remember all that trauma.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it wasn't just the hijacking. It was, you know, we talked about it in the last episode, a lot of things that had happened to me as a kid.
Yeah.
But I feel like.
Well, it's not just that. It's the trauma of the family. It's the secrets of the family. It's holding things inside. There are so many psychological things that go into that, Marla. Into the imprisonment that you put yourself in when you're in this unique situation.
That's really well said. I never thought of that, but you know, I discovered this healing modality called the healing codes. And when I started doing healing codes, you know, stuff just came up in layers, and it was so freeing. And I realized through that process, I had lived my whole life being kind of terrified of, you know, feeling really like vulnerable, like somebody could hurt me. Someone might be after me, you know,
sure.
Things like that. I mean, it sounds kind of crazy and paranoid, but I think it did start then. It started before then. But it's so interesting because the relationship I'm in now is a wonderful man, Joe Tippins, who also has an incredible story, his cancer story.
Oh yeah.
We should talk
absolutely
about that
amazing.
Another day.
Amazing.
Yeah. Have you,
wild.
Have we?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. No, so like I've followed it since our last conversation. It's been absolutely wild to see the healing process of this man.
It's fascinating. And now I probably shouldn't talk about who's putting up research studies, but his doctor from MD Anderson is now the head of the FDA.
Oh, wow.
And yeah.
Wow.
And he, you know, off the record has acknowledged.
Yep.
It was the fenbendazole that healed Joe. Joe was the only, you know, it's a dog dewormer, $10 a week to heal your cancer, no matter what kind it is. Don't let that get out.
No.
But.
Yeah, we do. No, we do not espouse medical treatments.
Right. Wink, wink.
I am not Dr. Oz. That's.
But Joe's family is amazing. I mean, they grew up on a ranch in western Oklahoma, actually the same town Arden Dorney's from, and every one of these siblings are just awesome people, so grounded, so solid, loving. We do a Sunday night happy hour with the siblings on Zoom, and it's like I feel like I'm part of a family for the first time in my life since I was a little kid. You know,
that's
I
great.
Get married, I have children. I felt like an alien in this world until all of this crap came to surface and I just got it out in the open and stopped feeling like I needed to hide. And, you know, really I'm so thankful for it. You know, I'm thankful for my uncle. I remember spending hours at night wondering, where is he? Where has he gone? When's he coming back? Literally just grieved the loss of him when he disappeared, because at that point we had moved back to Sisters and he was living in my grandmother's house and I would see him every single day. And, you know, I really was close to him. And then suddenly he has vanished and he was gone and he had become such a big part of my life. And, you know, to have him just taken away from me and to not know why until 10 years after he was dead. This seems unjust, but you know, if you subscribe like I do, that the veil is thin and nobody really actually is dead. It's the dead body, but their spirit's still here. I think, you know, I feel like the family was there guiding, helping me through all of this, you know, introducing me to the right people. There were people I've met who actually knew my uncle, who served with him in Black Ops. Mm. And, you know, what are the odds of that happening?
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, with that in mind, Marla, in our last few minutes here together, if you could ask your uncle LD, DB, as the world knows him, any one question, what would it be?
Hmm. Wow, I never pondered that before.
Yeah, you know, because I ponder that question honestly frequently about family members, friends that I've lost. Like, if I could have that one more moment of conversation,
yeah,
what would it be about? You know, even if 8-year-old Marla had the chance to ask her Uncle DB one last question, what would that question be?
I probably would ask him if he would do anything differently. You know, I would ask. I wish I could get back to you on that.
You can get back to me on that, because this is not your last appearance on Dudes and Beer, Marla.
Okay.
So you got time to think about it.
I do. But I'll probably make a list of questions. And, you know, there were many questions I asked him through the investigation, and the biggest one, and I actually, the night before I had my polygraph test with the FBI, I had this dream, and my dad and all of his brothers were there, and I was, you know, my family had kind of turned against me because of this. They were like,
yeah,
why are you doing this?
Yeah. No, because they
really
come under the magnifying
ugly
lens, too. They get the phone calls.
Yeah.
They get the phone
exactly
calls from the same producers.
That was before that started. That was before my story went public. This was still during the investigation. And but I had this dream that we were back in my grandmother's house. Of course, it looked totally different, but it was the house. And I wrote about this in the book, and I don't know if I told this part where I said, are you mad at me for going to the FBI? Mm. Because my sister especially was just furious with me that, oh my God, you know, if he's still alive, you're going to ruin his life and yada, yada, yada. And I was like, are you mad at me? And they were like, no, we're not mad at you. We wanted you to tell this story, you know? And so that was the biggest question then, is this okay that I'm doing this? You know, that I did this. And I probably now would say, I'd probably ask him, what do you want the movie to look like? You know, because part of me is like, I feel an obligation. I should have started earlier. I actually had a screenplay writer who wrote a script, and I thought, oh my gosh, this is so hokey. I thought it was so terrible.
I got some people, Marla. If you need help, let me know.
We're going to have to hurry it along. The 50th anniversary is in a year and a half. But here's the funny thing. In retrospect, that script, if you turned it into a comedy, if you weren't trying to tell a true story, like Men Who Stare at Goats, you know,
like Operation Dumbo
comedy,
Drop, like I'm just thinking about parachute laden movies now. That's all I'm going through is parachute laden comedies.
But I keep thinking of this Mel Brooks kind of a voice, you know, like it's a little bit of Get Smart,
okay,
it's a little bit of Blazing Saddles.
Well, but we can't,
you know,
remake Airplane.
Right. But you tell the right, no kidding. But you tell the truth.
Yeah.
You know, you tell the truth shrouded in that comedy, and it's like that could be funny.
That would be good,
you know,
stuff.
And I sort of think that's maybe the reason I was so mentally blocked in writing the screenplay, or really knowing what it should be like, And I think maybe I should call my agent up and run this by him.
Yeah, maybe just going out there comedy, like The Interview, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and you know, there was a movie that got made super fast recently that was so good. And I can't remember now the name of it, but it was sort of like Clue, like the board game Clue.
Oh, yeah. No, Knives Out.
Knives Out. Do you know that from concept to production to release, that was like microscopic?
Yeah, it that was like a no year, time. Year and a half. It was crazy.
Well, Christopher, you know, I'm thinking.
Well, hey, we can keep thinking. We can keep on thinking and thinking, Marla. I will gladly help you think all day long. We got each other's numbers. We go. Let's master plan the world together.
There you go.
That's where
Solving
I'm at.
Solving the world problems 12 ounces at a time.
Exactly. Exactly. We got nothing but COVID.
Hey, I got a kegerator in my kitchen.
We
now,
got
man.
Nothing but COVID time to do it, Marla.
Oh, Grace agrees.
Well,
my boyfriend already had a dog that was named after my mother.
That's nice.
And then we'd say goodnight, Gracie, and we decided we had to have a George. So we have two giant Saint Berdoodles that are just beautiful.
Wow. Yeah, those are big old dogs. Well, thank you so much for taking the time once again to come on the show to share this more than personal story and revealing story. I cannot wait until your next visit to come on and really crack this nut some more. I'm still reading the book. Tell everybody where they can go to get their copy of DB's Niece, The Raw, In the Raw, Unedited.
Well, and that is exactly how it is. It is In the Raw and Unedited because I wanted it out before the History Channel documentary came out. And so I slapped it up onto Amazon without formal editing.
Yeah.
It's just my own stream of thought. I did my own editing to it because at one time it was like 500 pages long, and I think I got it down around 300.
Yeah. So. It's within a 5.5-hour read on Kindle, folks.
There you go. Well, I'm told it's an easy read, and
it
I don't
is.
Know if that means I used small enough words or that it flowed good. But
yeah, the answer is yes.
Oh, yes to both. Okay. Well, it's been a pleasure, Chris. Thank you.
Absolutely. Anytime, Marla. I cannot wait until your next appearance. Please do hold the line while we close things out. While you are online checking things out, make sure to stop on by dudesandbeer.com. Go on by the Dudes and Beer store. The bookstore is where you can find DB's Niece, In the Raw, Unedited, by our guest tonight, Marla Wynn Cooper, as well as other people like Dr. John Hall, pretty much all of our guests, as well as some great equipment, things like that. Make sure to stop on by blackboxlive.tv. Give to the arts, folks. Give to those that are hurting right now from COVID. There are so many people out there affected. This, unlike 9/11, is something that truly will touch and impact every single person personally. So it's out there. Let's take care of each other. Let's take care of ourselves. And until next time, everybody, remember, if you can't be good at it. Stop on by the Dudes and Beer Knowledge Vault. That is where you can find all kinds of great stuff. Until next time, everyone, if you can't be good at it. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Dudes and Beer Podcast. To listen to our audio streams or chat with us live, download the official Dudes and Beer app for Android and iDevices, available on Google Play and iTunes markets. For more episodes, content, and information, visit us online at dudesandbeer.com. You can also find our episodes on Breach.tv, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, SoundCloud, iTunes, YouTube, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Dudes and Beer is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more about our sponsors and other podcasts on this network, visit hcuniversalnetwork.com. Thanks for listening, everybody.
And until next time, drink responsibly.